ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife Science.
When the James Webb Space Telescope looked back in time, as it does to observe the universe's earliest moments, it recently discovered something very peculiar. Hundreds of little red dots, and they're mysterious, and they are baffling astronomers. And are they stars or black holes or something else? So to tell us more about this and other scientific news around this week, we're joined once again by the redoubtable Associate Professor Charlie Limeweaver, astrophysicist at the ANU's Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics. Charlie, good evening to you. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Good evening, you non-black hole.
Yeah, I know. Well, I don't think I'm a black hole. I could be. You never know. See, if you're inside a black hole, you wouldn't know you were, Charlie.
Well, I don't want to get talking about that. That's a much more complicated thing that we want to talk about today.
Tell me about these little red dots. How did they appear?
So you're familiar with the James Webb Space Telescope, the newest, brightest, biggest infrared and red telescope is out there scanning the heavens for interesting objects. And what are the interesting objects they found recently in the last couple of years? There have been like 20 very recent papers on this. It's something called little red dots. And why they're interesting is because they emit lots and lots of radiation, but they're very red, and there's hardly any ultraviolet or bluish radiation coming out of them. And so this is unlike any other object, like a galaxy that's very, very far away, and it would not be able to do that because a lot of the light from a galaxy comes from big stars that give off a lot of UV, ultraviolet. So they see these little red dots. They sometimes call them rubies. And the question is, what in the world are these? Now, one recent model, and probably the best fitting model, trying to understand what they are, is something called, what are they called? Oh, well, they're called black hole stars. Now, you've heard of black holes, and you've seen images of black holes, right? The supermassive black hole in the center of our galaxy. You can see it. It's a black hole, but it has an accretion disk, and there's lots of heat coming off the accretion disk, and that's why we can see the black hole, even though the black hole itself doesn't give off any radiation. Anyway, that's a black hole that's being fed kind of slowly, and so the accretion disk, like the rings around Saturn, are slowly falling into the black hole.
We're all going to disappear into it one day, aren't we?
Well, not all of us. Not all of us. It depends on how closely...
Oh, you've got a safe haven, have you?
No. It depends on how far away you are from the... You know, it's true that a lot of the stuff in our current galaxy will fall into the center and fall into the black hole. But in order to fall in, you have to push stuff out. Things just don't... Matter of fact, here's an interesting thing for you. Gravity does not make things collapse. And you say, what?
Well, yes, it does.
No, it doesn't. For example, dig a hole straight through the Earth. Imagine if you could dig a hole straight through the Earth and make it a vacuum, and you drop a pen or a ball through it. What will happen to that? It'll go back all the way through, all the way to the outside on the surface, then come back through again, and back through again, and through it. It'll just go on and on and on. It will never collapse into the center of the Earth. It will just keep on going. But in order for it to collapse, you need some type of dissipation, some type of friction. And that is what allows the galaxy to collapse onto the center of the black hole in the center. But in order to do that, you have to have friction. That friction throws stuff out. In other words, there's no free lunch. You can't just collapse. You have to throw stuff out, get rid of angular momentum, and then you can collapse.
Okay.
And so picture a black hole, and a black hole has an accretion disk, and it's a lot of friction and stuff falling in. And if they're really big, they make quasars, the brightest objects in the universe, but also jets coming out of them. But imagine if you take a black hole and surround it, and stuff is falling in from all directions. That's kind of like a star. There's so much hydrogen around the black hole. It's like the black hole is in the center of a star. And all of that hydrogen is falling in from different directions, not an accretion disk in a two-dimensional plane like the rings of Saturn, but rather from every direction. And that's what they think this is. They call this a black hole star. So essentially a black hole that is embedded in so much hydrogen, and the hydrogen is being excited by the black hole as it falls in, then that is what's called a black hole star. And that's a new type of object. That's the best model we have for these little red dots.
Hey, speaking of stars and black holes, some interesting observations of a star swallowing a black hole, or maybe vice versa.
I love black holes. You gotta love black holes. They're so weird and so interesting. So this is gamma rays. You've heard of gamma rays, right? Yeah, X-rays, gamma rays. Gamma rays are the most energetic photons in the universe. And there's a satellite called the Fermi satellite, which in July of this year detected some gamma ray bursts. Now, but these gamma ray bursts were very different from others. Usually a gamma ray burst is a one-off thing. It goes boom from a particular direction and then no more from that direction. But this particular gamma ray burst went boom, then boom, then boom. There are three of them detected. Mm-hmm. And they said, wow, this is a periodic thing going on. What in the world could cause a periodic gamma ray burst? Because usually you think of, you know, gamma ray bursts could be a giant star that collapses and it's a supernova and gives off lots of gamma rays. But this one is, but supernova don't happen periodically. They don't go supernova, supernova, supernova. Anyway, this is periodic. And they think what might have happened is we have a giant star that's 1,000, maybe 10,000 times bigger than the black hole. A black hole has been swallowed by this star. Mm-hmm. The black hole has fallen in. So the star has swallowed the black hole, but then from the inside out, the black hole eats the star, and then it swallows the star. So once the star swallows the black hole, then the black hole swallows the star. And the reason why it could be periodic is because this black hole is in orbit around the center of mass of the black hole in the star. And so it would be rotating. And every time, I guess, it came close to us on the near side of this object, then it would produce some gamma ray bursts that would be detected by the Fermi satellite.
Wow.
So periodic gamma ray bursts being modeled as star swallows black hole swallows star.
Yeah. Hey, black holes, of course, implies. Now, I don't know why it's been weeks since I asked you, have we found out what dark matter is yet? I don't think we've got an answer.
But the answer is we still don't know. No, the search is on.
But ordinary sugar is being used to search for dark matter. Is it got that crazy?
Well, here's the thing. There are many, many candidates for dark matter.
Yep.
And some of these candidates are lighter than others. You know, you can have a heavy particle or a lighter particle. If you have a lighter particle, then you need a different type of detector, which essentially has a lot of hydrogen in it, because hydrogen is the smallest element, and smallest, it's got only one proton, and so it is more susceptible to being banged into, and it's visible to, when you bang into a hydrogen, you know, it goes boom, but if you bang into, let's say, a uranium, it goes boom, it just moves a tiny bit. So you want a detector that has lots of hydrogen densely packed. Now you could say, well, why don't you use hydrogen gas? Well, hydrogen gas is very, very rarefied, and there's not many hydrogen per cubic centimeter. But if you want to get lots and lots of hydrogen per cubic centimeter, you look at C6H12O6, H12, 12 of them in one small little molecule. And so what they do is they grow these big molecules, big crystals of normal sugar, and they have so much hydrogen in them that they could be one of the best detectors for a light version of dark matter.
So when you have 2 teaspoons of sugar, you're having quite a lot of hydrogen.
Oh, C6H12O6.
H12. Wow.
C6H12O6. 12.
No wonder it gives you a bit of an uplift.
This is molecular science at its crudest tonight, Phil.
Ah, okay. There we are. There are sugar being used for dark. Now, back on Earth, Charlie, there's some interesting findings about how dandelions use the wind.
Yeah, this is a wonderful story. There's a scientist, I think at Cornell University and some other universities, and she had a child, and the child picked the dandelion. You know how those dandelions, when they have the seed pods, and they're all like a nice sphere, and you blow on them, right? Mm-hmm. And the child blew on them, and the child noticed that when you blow from the top, the seeds don't come off very easily, but you blow from the bottom, the seeds come off very easily.
Oh.
And you can think, well, why would you want to do that? Now, if you were a dandelion, Phil, you would want your seeds to be scattered by the wind, right?
Yeah.
But you want the wind to be an updraft so it takes the seeds away rather than a downdraft that puts the seeds very close to where you grew up yourself. So you want to fall off when there's an updraft and stay put when there's a downdraft, and that's what you see when you blow on these things.
Isn't that interesting? So there's an evolutionary advantage.
Yes, everything's evolution. But anyway, it has evolved such that when you blow on it from the top, it says, oh, I'm staying here. And if you blow on it from the bottom, oh, goodbye, I'm off to procreate. And they measured this with very delicate measurements of how much force you need to remove one of these seeds and its little parachute from the center core, and they verified this, and they looked at the at the way the seeds are attached to the central core, and they saw that, oh, there's an asymmetry there that allows it, if you peel it one way, if you push it up, it comes off, and if you push it down, it kind of hangs around. And so that's science at its best, used applied to dandelions.
Look at that. And speaking of evolution, if you look back along the evolutionary tree, our existence, it seems, might have something to do with our superior ability to deal with lead when compared to Neanderthals.
Yeah, yeah. You know that lead is not, you've probably read that lead is not very good for...
No, it's terrible. It's terrible poison.
It's terrible. Yeah. Now, but you also know that Queen Elizabeth used to smear lead-based makeup all over her face.
This is Elizabeth I, not the recent queen.
That's right. That's right. Not the second, the first. And you know that the Romans used to have lead pipes that they've had the water. So when you had lead pipes, that put a lot of lead in the water. And then when children or others drank it, that would get embedded in their teeth. And so what these scientists did was look at many, many different types of bones and teeth and see, okay, what you do is you just put a laser beam onto the tooth. It turns the tiny, tiny piece of the tooth into gas, put it through a mass spectrometer, and they see, okay, what fraction of how many lead atoms are in that particular tooth, or how many this, or how many that. Anyway, they looked just for lead. And they found that the lead in the teeth of almost all of the fossils, Homo erectus or Australopithecines, were just chock full of lead. And they say, how in the world did so much lead get into these people? They didn't have lead pipes. But what they did do, you may have heard of cavemen. And the water that comes through caves particularly is laden with lead at higher levels than we want today. And so that's what they think. Their hypothesis is that lead was almost everywhere in water that had come recently through rocks. And so they said, now, they looked also at the genes of Homo sapiens sapiens and Homo sapiens neanderthalensis to compare compare us to Neanderthals. And they found that there were genes in the human genome that were kind of new. And when they grew the genes in what are called organoids, little brains in petri dishes. And they saw that the brains in petri dishes, they hated lead. And that's kind of what you might expect since lead poisoning, we know, produces lots of mental problems and problems with speeching. Talking. And so they said, well, what happens? So they found out that the modern Homo sapiens sapien genes was more immune to lead poisoning than was the older version in Neanderthals. And they recognized that immunity to lead poisoning also allowed them to another gene called FOXP2 or something, that was enabled people to speak. It was very closely associated with the ability to speak. And so having this new type of Homo sapiens sapien gene, not the old Neanderthal gene, gave us more of an immunity to the lead poisoning that was obviously very, very high in all of these fossils that they were able to analyze.
How about that? Charlie Lineweaver is with us. Now, speaking of evolution, those of us alive are a mixture of DNA. That's obviously been successful, but that does include DNA that makes some people less sane than others.
Yeah.
Well, I'm interested in this story, Charlie.
Yeah, this is a story by a group, I think in Amsterdam, and you may have heard that now that we can sequence the human genome, we can sequence thousands of human genomes, right? And when you have thousands of human genomes, even more, you can say, okay, who is tall? And then you do what's called genome-wide association studies, and you say, oh, all the tall people have these genes are more frequent in them. And you say, oh, who are the people with the blue eyes? And you say, these are the genes that are associated with blue eyes. But you can also do the same thing with schizophrenia and all kinds of mental problems. You can go through the list of mental problems and you can say, okay, of these 10,000 people whose genomes we have, here are the, 10 or 100 or 200 who have this particular problem. They're all schizophrenics. And then you say, they are more likely to have this gene, that gene, this gene. All right? So you see how that works? So that's called genome-wide association studies. So you can look at these genes and figure out which of the genes associated with this disease. And then what you can do is the following. You know, Phil, if all of the genes you're looking at have the same thing, then you know that the common ancestor had that.
Yeah.
But let's say that, let's say you and your wife and some large member of your family, large fraction of your family, had a particular disease. And they say, oh, here's why you have the disease, because you have this particular mutation, right? Mm-hmm. But if the mutation is not only in your family, but also in related families, it's, oh, that's an older gene. That mutation happened earlier. But if it's related to all people in England, but not people in, let's say, Sardinia, then you know, oh, it's maybe 10,000 years old, but it's not 50,000 years old. Why? Because all of the people in England might have a common ancestor 10,000 years ago, but it doesn't go back far enough to have spread to Sardinia. In other words, the more spread out a mutation is, the older that mutation was.
Okay.
You follow me?
Yep, got it.
Okay. So what they did was figure out, they went all the way back to chimpanzees and even earlier and said, okay, the genes that are associated with high intelligence, you know, we tripled our brain size in the last 6 million years since chimps. Mm. And so they said, okay, what are the genes associated with that? And then they figured out, okay, what are the genes associated with schizophrenia and other mental diseases? And they found out that the genes that are associated with higher intelligence are also associated with insanity or mental problems.
Is that right? So they evolved together.
They evolved together. That's the main conclusion. So in human-like intelligence also comes with the downside. There's a cost, a trade-off, as we say in evolution. Mm. And you may know the most intelligent people you know, the people that I know are the most intelligent are also the craziest. So there must be some correlation going on
somehow. Okay. All right, Charlie, just before you go, The House of Dynamite's be the big hit movie at the moment. It does give us some insight into how warfare has been good for technological development.
Well,
giving too much away about the plot.
Right, I won't give out much, but it's a very popular movie. I saw it last night. Yeah. I thought, well, this is interesting. And it's all about, you know, warfare, nuclear warfare. We're all in danger of nuclear warfare. But what I want to do is make a connection between a more scientific analysis of human society. There's a guy named Peter Churchin, who's a Russian-American, kind of like a scientific historian. He goes around collecting data from all different societies all over the world, and he tries to make large generalizations. And one of the generalizations he has made is that when you have high population, you also get warfare.
Mm-hmm.
But he also said, and when you have warfare, you have technological development. Now, anybody who studied all the technological development that happened during World War II, that would be no surprise. But he's generalizing that over thousands and thousands, 10,000, 50,000 years of human history and saying, yes, warfare has been a good thing as far as developing technology has been concerned. And so that is the you might call that the upside of warfare, but it's kind of like, you know, they also say, hey, why do you have these religious groups and tribal affinities? Well, that also is a result of all this tribal warfare, because if you think your group is much, much better than the other group, then you will go out and kill the other group, and then you will survive and they won't. At least that's a crude version of the thesis. If you're interested, read this book, a new book by Peter Turchin, T-U-R-C-H-I-N.
T-U-R-C-H-I-N.
It's about it's called the Holocene Transformation and its connection with the evolution of complex societies.
All right, Charlie, terrific to talk. Great as always, and appreciate it. So let's hope the world doesn't end before we speak again.
Yeah.
Thanks, Charlie.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.